Reading on electronic devices before bedtime can disrupt the body's circadian clock. Details on this and other new sleep research this hour. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We spend the hour with Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He'll talk about the latest news and research on sleep, including a new study that suggests when it comes to sleeping patterns, there are more than just larks and owls. Dr. Dykin will also answer your questions. Share your sleep problem or unusual sleep experience this hour. First, let's check the hour's latest news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're going to be delving into sleep research and news, the latest research and news having to do with why we get good sleep and why we don't get sleep. It's a vast, largely unexplored territory. It revolves around our brain, and to do that with us, to look at this research, neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin is with us, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and we welcome him to our Iowa City studio, as we like to do three or four times a day. Dr. Dykin, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
Number of things we'll talk about, new research this hour. I want to invite you to share your sleep problem or your unusual sleep experience. Perhaps on the positive side, you've changed something in your life that's led to better sleep. We'd also be interested in that. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, let's get to this, because we had a with the holidays just passed, Dr. Dykin, a number of people got new smartphones or tablets, electronic gadgets of all type, and we have then this news coming out at about the same time. Reading on electronic devices before bedtime can disrupt the body's circadian clock, making it harder to fall asleep and become alert in the morning, according to a study, a new one from Brigham Women's Hospital in Boston, Brigham Young. Tell us, we've long known that using some electronics doesn't help us sleep, or does it?
Well, especially this electronics, and it depends on what kind of lighting is coming from that electronics. And I think Dr. Seisler's laboratory, who's well known for circadian rhythm research from Harvard, they looked that the light associated with some of these electronic devices was blue light. Blue light is the kind of light we use for treating seasonal affective disorder, where people in the winter may not get enough bright light, and we can often fool the system and prolong their day by exposing them to more blue light, which helps depress melatonin, which makes us normally sleepy at night. So during the day, when the sun goes down, melatonin is released. Well, you can fool that system with blue light, and that's what is associated with some of these devices. So if you're trying to lie down to go to sleep, and you want to do last-minute electronics, and you're looking at the screen, and it's emitting a blue light at you, well, it's giving you bright light, and it's fooling your system into saying it's not time to go to sleep. And what their study showed is that the patients do tend to go to sleep significantly later and have more difficulties then because of that.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if all e-readers emit blue light, or are there some that do and some that don't?
No, and in fact, they even listed some of the stuff, but they only tested, I guess, the iPads, the iPhones, the iPods, the new Nook Color, the Kindle Fire, all had similar blue light emissions, but the original Kindle didn't have this blue light. It had its own light source that was reflected as much as ambient light. Like you might have a regular book, turn on the light by your nightstand.
Mm. I wonder if on an e-reader you can also dim it or turn it to what is a night setting, so you have a black background with, if you would have, the faintest possible white letters on that black background. Would that help possibly?
Wouldn't that have been nice that they looked at that? Because we usually use a degree of illuminance 5,000 to 10,000 lux. So the illumination degree, the amount of that blue light makes a difference too. So I don't think they really addressed that illuminance level, but wouldn't that make sense?
Mm-hmm. 1-866-780-9100. Our sleep expert, the neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin, is with us this hour to field your questions. And let's address this tweet from Julia that also concerns technology and sleep, Dr. Dykin. She writes, "My Fitbit is saying I sleep for only 3 hours per night, but I am in bed for 9. Is this bad technology or is there an issue?"
Thought about this for a long time, and in response to this question, I don't even know what a Fitbit is. So I have no idea.
Well, one of these gadgets that you put on that measures – it can measure your walking, your exercise, the steps, but it also measures whether you're restless in bed at night.
Yeah, so I wouldn't have any idea. You know, there are some people – Christopher Reeves was a hero of mine, and, you know, he broke his neck and he was paralyzed. And, for example, if this machine, which I know nothing about, was monitoring the depth of your sleep by the lack of movement – then it would look like Christopher Reeves was always asleep because he didn't move. Mm-hmm. Actually, he had some body movements, et cetera. But essentially, he would always look asleep. So it depends on what they're actually monitoring, how they're determining sleep. Classically, the way we determine sleep in the sleep laboratory is looking at the brain waves, the eye movements, and the muscle tone. And as such, I would have to think that in most people who sleep 7 to 9 hours per night, if given the opportunity as normal adults, I would probably get more sleep out of that person. But it is some technical artifact could be suspected, especially if she feels well rested. But she could be a short sleeper, and those people do exist.
No one can sleep 3 hours a day and feel well rested.
The feet of the bell-shaped curve are short sleepers. And there are some people who can sleep less than 5 hours and feel rested. And, you know, I love a delicious nap, and I don't know if I would want to be blessed with that. You know, give me a good nap any old time. But, you know, that is the question. So sometimes technology is looking at the movement, and the paucity of movement equals sleep. So I don't know how that machine actually works, but okay. Sometimes we can see technical artifact, if you will.
Okay. Julia would be then would be well for Julia to look into exactly what the Fitbit is measuring and perhaps see if that you measure a lot of things in your sleep clinic that aren't necessarily brain waves and so forth.
But if she feels good, don't worry about it.
Okay. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Mason City. Teresa is with us from Mason City. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
What's bothering your sleep or someone you know?
Well, I actually emailed Dr. Dykin, and we've had a couple of emails on my son. He's a 19-year-old college student, and he goes to South Dakota, and we've talked about his sleepwalking. He's actually, this summer, he actually got into his truck and started it by the time we could get out there, and in college, he actually walked a good 10-15 minutes to his class, and he thought it was 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was actually 3 o'clock in the morning when he realized he was sleepwalking. So my question is, we had no surgery just last on the 17th of December here. He had a deviated septum, and when I got him home, they had him on Tylenol with codeine, and he actually got up that night a couple times trying to get up and walk in his sleep. And then Christmas Eve, he had his splints taken out a week ago, and Christmas Eve, he actually woke up a couple times and just walking around, and because we've got to be really careful not to bump his nose. And he actually started screaming, and by the time we got to him, he had stripped his bed of his blankets, and my husband had to grab him kind of from behind to try to restrain him because he was running from something or just scared to death. Mm. So is there anything that we can give him at night? Because we're worried he's going to run into something.
See, I think we've been over that, you know, and I don't believe I've seen him. I don't believe I've gone through his history. I don't believe I've gone through his exam. And, you know, we've heard of people who haven't slept. We've had people sleepwalk in front of trucks, etc. But you must see the patient. You must look under the hood. You must know the history. And I still believe I don't know any of these things to that extent to give you safe, valid recommendations. And I know what you're saying as a parent. You're watching something. You're seeing something. You want the answer yesterday. But doctors went to the same schools. Nurses went to the same schools. They're good people, generally good people, because they went into professional help. But you got to be careful when you're selling something over a radio show and you have not looked under the hood. You have not looked at the history. Medicines can be dangerous. This is a very, very scary situation that I empathize, but you must rely on the people who know your son the best and follow with their expertise. What does his doctor think? And one of those things is he is an adult. I don't know if we're all privy to what that doctor has told your son personally, but that's where it then also gets very, very concerning for a parent of an adult. I really have no idea what's going on with my children and their health because they tell me it's none of my business. And they are over 18 years old, legally an adult, and they keep that from me. And there are some things I'm glad they keep from me. Mom and Dad don't want to be around on the prom night date, and we also don't want to ruin it for anyone else. But it does become very, very concerning for a parent. They're always your children, no matter how old they get. And I'm not sure if he's scheduled to see us in the future or not. But once we do see him, then the next time you call, I'll have to tell you, well, I can't tell you what we've discussed because of the confidentiality and the HIPAA laws, et cetera. But God bless you. I know you're worried about your son, but I would talk to the doctors and nurses and the healthcare team that work with him very, very closely. And again, we'd be happy to see him here at the university.
Okay, Teresa, thank you very much.
Oh, okay, thanks.
Okay, Teresa in Mason City, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to George in Norwalk. George, also sleepwalking in a question that you have.
Well, I've had a few where sleepwalking incidents, and I had a pretty severe one where I woke up in a hotel room and punched out the window and dove out the actual window on the second floor and actually lived through it to tell. That's been a while since that happened, but I do dream very vividly. It's been probably 15 years since that happened, but I just always worry about something like that reoccurring. You know, obviously when I stay in hotels and I stay on the upper floor or whatever, sometimes I even move furniture in front of the windows or something. It's just...
Okay. So you're still worried even though that was 15 years in the past, Dr. Daikin?
Yeah, and that's one of the things we recommend. There's a lot of things that can be associated with sleepwalking or sleep behaviors. And again, a parasomnia is often a physical movement, a behavior, if you will, that's associated with sleep, or comes out of sleep. So sleepwalking is the classic thing that young children often do from sleep, and they often outgrow this by age 15 or 16. But we do have adults that will often continue this kind of behavior. This kind of behavior can be seen in a parasomnia that often arises in the first third of night out of what we call stage N3 sleep. It can also occur with seizures. It can also occur in certain psychosocial diagnoses. It can also occur as a result of certain medication effects, alcohol effects, etc. It can also be seen in post-traumatic stress-like disorders in people who have been at war and have been under extreme trauma. It could also be seen in older men who are developing Parkinsonism-like disorders, what we call the REM sleep behavior disorder. So there's a big differential diagnostic category. But for all of these disorders, we recommend that what you've already done, smart thinking, you know, the patient know thyself, protect the bedroom environment, protect the window area, keep the bedroom safe, sharp objects away from the bed, common sense approach. And oftentimes, that is the best approach. On any given night or any given day, we may have difficulty even driving down the highway. Probably our biggest risk is dying in a car wreck because it happens so frequently. But good common sense approach, good driving habits, good sleeping habits in this case will probably serve you just as well as a $1 million visit to a sleep specialist. But if things get out of hand, let us know and we can, again, monitor the behavior.
George in Norwalk, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're here with, if you just joined us, neurologist Dr. Eric Dyken, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, looking at some of the latest research on sleep and also answering your questions, your sleep problem questions, unusual sleep experiences. If you'd like to share them, 1-866-780-9100. One area, Dr. Dyken, where sleep and sleep research crossed our news in recent weeks. Earlier this month, the U.S. Intelligence Committee report on torture gave us insights into some of the CIA's most grisly interrogation techniques. And among these techniques, so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, detainees, some of them were subjected to sleep deprivation for up to a week. What happens to a person who is denied sleep?
Well, you can go into what we call N1 sleep or sleep drunkenness state. We're actually running on fumes. N1 sleep where you can appear awake and you can just be going through the motions. And we have some sleep disorders where people have difficulty with sleep drunkenness where they'll work throughout an entire weekend. We had a fellow who worked counting cattle on the weekend. And when they looked at his notes, he appeared there every single day, but the notes were just a mishmash. He was just working on fumes and really was asleep on his feet. So you don't function well. You don't cognate well. You don't have good memory for things. You can make dangerous mistakes. You could turn the wrong way on a one-way street.
And if you're an interrogator, you're wanting accurate information. So it tells me what you're saying right now is you don't get reliable information from people who've been sleep deprived. Is that what I'm reading into that?
Well, you might read into it. I mean, the question, if it's a simple question, did you do it or not, Bob? And you can say yes or no, that gets to the point where you could probably still say, yes, I did it, or no, I didn't. Or I may say, yes, so you just stop this torture. And you think about it. Does sleep deprivation hurt a nerve ending? Well, we know that it doesn't really hurt a nerve ending, but there's nothing worse than being deprived of sleep. And if you add one more thing onto it, pain, anxiety, stress, pressure, whatever they're holding you for, that's a synergism. It makes it 10 million times worse.
Can sleep deprivation result in death or permanent damage of any sort?
Has it ever been documented? Now, I asked that when I gave grand rounds at Davenport, and somebody said there was a documentation of a death from sleep deprivation. And other than falling asleep behind the wheel of a 40-ton rig causing death, I have never heard of that except in animal studies because it would be unethical to do that to a human being. Now, the world record was voluntarily held at one time by a 14-day stint of no sleep, a high school kid at Stanford who did this for Dr. Dement, just volunteered, tried to see how long he could stay up. And on day 13, he was shooting baskets, looking happy and smiling as long as he wasn't under stress or pressure and was active. And then on day 14, boom, from what I recall, he crashed for 24 hours, woke up none the worse for wear and tear. But that was without stress and pressure. But I do not know that it's possible that you can keep awake without that kind of torture. Mm-hmm. But we do know with animals, over a 16, 17, 20-day period, rats that have been exposed to this by studies done by Rechtstoff and the University of Chicago, they will die.
Let's go to Kai. Kai is joining us from Iowa City for our look at sleep research news, also answering your questions. We have time to squeeze in Kai's question before we take a short break. Hello, Kai.
Hi. I have a question about ever since I was little, I've been having, like, sleep paralysis where I'll fall asleep and I'll wake up, but my body won't be able to move. I've read it's because I'm waking up during REM sleep. Do you know anything about that or why it's caused?
Yeah. In fact, if you look at the Atlas of Sleep Medicine, we have a wonderful video. Dr. Chakraverty is one of the editors. And now with a lot of the books that come out, they have video concomitants. And we have a great video of a patient in sleep paralytic event. Great is relative. It's morbidly fascinating. It was great that we were able to diagnose the patient, but he appears to be in REM sleep, but he's not asleep. He is paralyzed. It's what he came in complaining about. Scared him to death. He thought he was dying. He thought he was having a stroke or some sort of seizure. But what it was sleep paralysis. 40% of us or more, especially after sleep deprivation, will have at least one event of sleep paralysis in our lifetime. It was originally brought up in the Chinese Book of Dreams before the birth of Christ, and they used to think it was due to very unhappy ancestors with your performance during the day, so they were punishing you. And it's gone through the incubus, the demon sitting at the foot of your bed, to now what's a little more science, but again, normal people can do it, and in our patient who really had bad sleep paralysis, he had some genetic flavor that made him a little more prone to having it, as were his family members having it, and he did really well once he was diagnosed, and we treated him with a tricyclic antidepressant.
So Kai, is this sleep paralysis bothering you?
It's been happening to me ever since I was, like, 6 years old, so pretty much as long as I can remember, and it happens, like, I'd say once a month or maybe more, maybe up to 5 times a month.
And it's very scary for someone who's not had it, isn't it, Kai?
Yeah, it's kind of like someone's, like, yelling at you and there's, like, some presence in the room, but you can't move or see it or call up for help. It's really weird.
Mm-hmm. Final words of advice for Kai, what she should do, Dr. Dykin?
Well, one of the things is you can talk to your family medicine doctor, and if they think you need a referral to the sleep center, we'd be happy to see you. But you don't want that to be a negatively conditioned problem. I've got to the point where I've done it a couple of times, but I know about it. It doesn't bother me so much, so it's morbidly fascinating, but it can be very frightening. And if you become afraid of going to bed, it's like Pavlov's dog, the steak and the bell. After a while, that fear of having sleep paralysis, which is not something that is going to kill you, although you don't know it, it can scare you so that you have insomnia at night. If that becomes an overriding problem, you might ask your doctor if they'll treat you with a tricyclic antidepressant on an as-needed basis, or even send us to see us.
Okay, Kai, thank you very much for your call from Iowa City. And we'll be back in the second half hour with neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, the latest news and research concerning sleep and answering your questions. 1-866-780-9100.
Taking my time, lying here staring at the ceiling, waiting for a sleepy feeling.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, spending the hour with neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, exploring the latest news and research on sleep, why we get good sleep, why we, many of us, too many of us, tens of millions of us have chronic sleep problems. We're answering your questions or addressing your unusual sleep experiences. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Before we go back to callers and other tweets or emails, Dr. Dykin, a new study in the journal Personality and Individual Differences suggests that when it comes to sleeping patterns, some people are neither owls nor larks. We've heard this a long time. Owls, of course, staying up late into the night, prefer that, prefer getting up later in the morning as well. Larks are those morning people, perhaps people we envy, have that morning energy springing out of bed. And now this new study says that when it comes to these sleeping patterns, there are more than just larks and owls. In addition, there are people who feel energetic in both the mornings and the evenings, as well as people who, poor people these are, they feel lethargic the entire day. What does this tell you?
You ever felt lethargic all day?
Absolutely.
Have you ever
Some days are like that.
Holidays come through and then you stay up all night working on a project, just so happy, or else everybody just woke up and then grandpa brought in the walleye and mom put it on and you had the butter all over it. And you, I mean, I think what they did with the owls and the larks is they looked at the bell-shaped curve, the different end of the spectrums, people who like to stay up later and people who like to wake up early. And even throughout one's lifetime, that can change. And it's normal for young adolescents to want to stay up later because their circadian biologic clock is set a little bit differently, so that young adolescents tend to stay up later and sleep in later. Whereas you get to be my age, you tend to go to bed earlier and you tend to wake up earlier, a little bit more larkish. But I'll tell you, when I watched that cartoon Shrek and I heard Hallelujah for the first time, I stayed up all night playing guitar. And so all of a sudden I became a night owl, and I'm on call every other night essentially, but I'm actually – and I think there's a blend of all of this, and this is what they imply, because if you are actually wide awake 24 hours – and we talked about that. Have they ever monitored a person who didn't get sleep, whether it's falling asleep in the middle of torture? And that's what that's implying. My thought is, I think what they did is they just looked at the bell-shaped curve. And someone who's sleepy all the time, that's why we have the International Classification of Sleep Disorders. There's 60 to 90 different pathologies that can make you pathologically sleepy 24 hours. And that's not normalcy.
Let's go back to our phones in Iowa City. Deb is joining us. Hi, Deb.
Hello.
You're on the air. Welcome to our program with Dr. Eric Daikin.
Thank you. I am calling because I have, for it feels like my entire life, been a very fitful sleeper. And you're just talking about night owls. I've felt like I've been a night owl. I worked at one point a 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. shift, and that seemed perfect for me because I stayed up couple hours when I got home and slept until 9, and it was fabulous. But when I'm not on a schedule like that, I have a very hard time falling asleep, and I wake up many, many times during the night. And when I have to get up in the morning, I feel a lot of times sort of like I have a hangover, and have a very hard time getting up in the morning. And I've never really been able to find a solution to this. I was wondering if the doctor has any ideas about that.
Deb in Iowa City. Thanks, Dr. Daikin.
Well, as you implied, when you're not on a schedule like that, and that's one of the problems, I think, with society. The National Sleep Foundation in 2002 did a Roper poll, and they showed that 90-some percent of people with fair to poor health have a major problem with sleep or sleepiness 3 to 5 times per week. And one of the things is we don't have to be, quote unquote, on a schedule, because we can work 24 hours a day. And let's say that you're more of a night owl kind of a person, genetically wired to be able to stay up later. But if you're not on the schedule and you're allowed to free roam, again, sometimes we need discipline, if you will. We need that kind of a schedule. That's just one potential hypothesis. For good sleep hygiene, which they call cognitive behavioral therapeutic interventions, some of the basic things they tell us to do is to have a good, quiet, comfortable, relatively cool sleeping environment for most of us. You pick out the time that is routinely the best time for you to try to go to bed. You have some sort of activity like reading something very soporific, sleepy, boring, if you will, until your eyes are ready to drop. And then you try to sleep throughout the night in that environment and wake up at a routine bedtime 7 nights a week throughout the year, that kind of a thing. But many of us can't do that kind of a schedule, if you will. But that's where we often start out with a sleep diary. And then oftentimes that diary, keeping that diary, filling in notes, is evidence to other problems where you say, well, I do wake up gasping, short of breath with my loud snore. Ooh, then I might think it's sleep apnea. Well, I do wake up punching and screaming and breaking through windows. Ooh, that could be REM behavior disorder, sleepwalking, night terrors, a bad response to medication, as we've already alluded today. There are so many different things that a full history and physical examination that a healthcare professional can often offer at the general practitioner level, the backbone of medicine in the United States. And that's what I would suggest. Try to keep a schedule, your schedule, and keep it for 3 weeks. If you're still having a problem, present that diary to your general practitioner, your PA, your nurse, and then discuss them if the problem is still continuing. What does this show you about my problem, and where can it lead to some sort of therapeutic intervention that can make me feel better?
Okay, Deb, does that give you a place to start?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Deb. Let's go to Shelley. Shelley is with us. Hi, Shelley. What's your problem?
Hi. Well, I chronically only sleep for about 3 hours at a time. I get up pretty much every 3 hours, and I've been doing it for most of my life.
But then the total sleep time during a 24-hour period would be what?
About 3 hours.
3 hours for 24 hours. So not only do you only sleep 3 hours at a time, but that's your total sleep for a 24-hour period.
Yes.
How do you feel, Shelley? I got to step in here and play doctor. Dr. Dykin's taking a sip of coffee here, so I got to ask the questions. How do you feel after having this 3 hours of sleep?
Most days I'm exhausted. Some days I feel okay. But generally, I'm tired all the time. And I've tried taking, like, diphenhydramine or Ambien, but same problem happens. I wake up in 3 hours.
Dr. Dykin.
I pretty much sleepwalk throughout the day.
Not pleasant. Sorry to hear that.
I was wondering if there's, like, there's some long-term physical implications. Especially over the last few years, I've gained a whole lot of weight. And I've heard that lack of sleep can help increase the amount of cortisol, stress hormone. I was wondering if the doctor knew anything about that.
Well, if you've gained a whole lot of weight, and we've talked about that a lot, again, when we look at weight, certain levels of weight we know are automatically associated with obstructive apnea. I have obstructive sleep apnea, and I have partial blindness in my right eye because of the low oxygen. I'm more prone to that kind of a problem. So low oxygen, your heart, your brain, your eye, your kidneys, is not a good thing, and it's so common. 15, 18, maybe 50 million Americans, they say that maybe 80% of apneics are underdiagnosed. But if the weight is elevated, that would be my first concern. And one of my thoughts is rule it out or rule it in, and then assess how much you are sleeping. And oftentimes, as has been suggested by some of these home monitoring devices, how much are you actually sleeping? How much do you feel you're sleeping? Because bottom line is, what is the difference? Well, there may be a big difference physiologically and then symptomatically and then as far as your life satisfaction and quality of living. So my thought is if the weight is way up and you're having this kind of problem sleeping, I'd rule out sleep apnea first with the overnight sleep study. Have the doctors done a sleep study on you?
Well, no. I suspect the weight came as a result of me not sleeping.
And there still may be a problem after that, but Dr. Francois Boud, who was president of the American Heart Association and chairman of cardiology here and a good friend and colleague, often says that he believes that the weight gain can often lead to apnea, and the apnea often can lead to weight gain. But it's still a significant problem. And people can still have sleep-related problems. If you look at the international classification, there are 60 to 90 differential diagnostic categories of things that can lead to sleep-related difficulties. And as we've said over and over, you're on the radio talking from afar. I'm not really able to do a full history, a full physical exam, but when someone's only sleeping 3 hours and the first thing they tell me is I've had marked gains in weight, I would still look at that because low oxygen to your heart and your brain is a bad thing, and then see where the dust settles with the rest of the sleep-related problems. There could be a secondary condition to insomnia that we may have more success addressing after we've taken care of the primary problem of low oxygen to the heart or the brain as evidenced by apnea. But we could hypothesize, but I would see a good healthcare professional, have a full history and examination, and I'd start with your general practitioner.
Shelley, thank you for your call from Iowa City. I hope that sleep situation improves for you.
Thank you.
Lori in Des Moines asked this question of you, Dr. Daikin. I know I have sleep apnea, but I don't think I would wear the CPAP. How dangerous is this condition really? Now, for those, you'll have to remind us again what the CPAP is and answer the question, please.
Yeah. And sleep apnea, some of us, due to the essentially the shape of our throat, when the muscles relax throughout our body, including those in the back of our throat, especially in apneics, it gets so floppy that when we suck in, it's like a wet straw and our airway closes. One of the best way to keep the floppy airway open in adults is the use of continuous positive airway pressure therapy, CPAP, which is a small mask that goes over the nose or over the nose and mouth that delivers a gentle column of air that acts as a stent to keep the airways open. It's not the only therapy. We also have positional therapies for some people who are prone to having their airways obstruct primarily when they lay flat on the back. Gravity tends to pull airway closed in that condition. Or oral devices. If you have moderate to mild sleep apnea, an oral device that the dentists, even here at the University of Iowa College of Dentistry, are actively utilizing in patients successfully. There are surgical techniques, which we usually keep in the back burner because they can have a lot of negative effects. But in people with kissing tonsils, if there's something in the way of the throat, take it out. But there are a variety of different therapeutic interventions that people actually do quite well with. But as you say, there are options. Knowing whether you have apnea or not is the first thing, and then seeing whether you're open to CPAP, oral device, positional therapies, surgical therapies, weight loss therapies, and we could go on and on.
What about Lori's question, how dangerous is sleep apnea?
It's very dangerous, potentially. Again, it's not the first cigarette that gets somebody. But what we've seen, and Dr. Redline has seen from Harvard, and Dr. Terry Young from the Wisconsin cohort, and you can Google all those names, when they looked at thousands of patients over 4 to 12-year periods of untreated sleep apnea around 20 events per hour where a person would stop breathing. That's an apnea hypopnea index where they stop breathing about 20 times per hour. Untreated over 4 to 12-year periods, these people are higher risk for stroke, cardiac dysrhythmia as evidenced by atrial fibrillation, heart disease, and potentially death. And low oxygen to your heart and brain, it just makes sense. It's not a good thing.
1-866-780-9100. Have time for a few more calls or emails. Katie is with us from Monticello. Hi, Katie.
Hi. So my son is going to be 3 in February, and he has recently, I don't know, say 6 months ago, he woke up maybe like an hour and a half after falling asleep, and is just terrified, screaming, shaking, can't move, sweaty, and then, you know, I pick him up and kind of, he looks around like he's never been in his room before, he doesn't know where he's at, and then about 5 minutes later, maybe 10, he'll calm down and just go right back to sleep. So my question is it like a night terror or is it the sleep paralysis or something that you were saying, talking about before?
Mm-hmm. And is it normal for this age, Dr. Daikin?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Katie.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
No, go ahead. You were going to add something.
Oh, yeah. And is it normal for this age? And also, I mean, he's also been having more nightmares, which he's never had before either.
Okay.
Yeah, around that age, if this is, I mean, a lot of different things, and they get scary for a parent, but pavor nocturnus or pavor incubus in adults, night terror. So it's a nice Latin term, if you will, so that we can sound like we're really, really smart. It's a night terror. Sounds like a night terror. Could be a lot of different things. But right around this age, before a child has good use of verbal communicative skills, all according to Anna Freud, Sigmund's daughter, did a lot of work on child-related parasomnias. And she said that during these growing, trying times for children, they often will catharse, if you will, their inner stresses and pressures through these nocturnal night terrors. And once they get better use of language use, that they often resolve. And they have parallels to these where they had a lot of children who were actually buried alive in a kidnapping in a bus in California many years ago. And a lot of the little kids wound up having these night terrors and nightmares. But as they went through counseling, they had marked improvement. And as their ability to use verbal language skills improved, there was a great reduction in the night terrors. So night terrors generally improve as the child gets older, and it doesn't mean anything bad about their substance, their capabilities, their cognitive capabilities. They're good kids, but if you actually did these modified Rorschach tests on them, there might be just a little bit more problem with them catharsing their inner stresses or pressures. And they've said that family counseling often leads to marked improvement in children with these kind of issues. Sometimes you really can't put your finger on, well, what is it that kicked this off for my child? Like a kidnapping, thank goodness, but oftentimes meeting with your pediatrician and talking about this at great length and looking at any issues that might be stressful, if you will, might be really therapeutic, even above medications.
Okay, Katie, thank you for sharing
Wonderful.
Your story.
Thank you.
All right.
Good luck.
Wally in Bradford is with us. Hi, Wally. Coming up to the end of our hour, please make your question brief. Thank you.
Got a question for the good doctor. I find myself waking up at night and my head is all wet with sweat and the pillow's sweaty. Is that a concern?
Well, I would think so. There are a lot of people with hyperhidrosis, and it really helped me for wrestling to lose weight. But this sounds like it's an unusual thing for you, and unless you've been doing it all your life, there are some things that can make you wake up sweaty. Well, one thing is, again, I always go back to the sleep apnea. We know that when we stop breathing at night, that your get up and go, your central nervous system, fight or flight system, which makes you sweat, makes your eyes dilate. You know, if you're in a room with the tiger, get out of the room. That system can really be revved up. And if your heart's beating and you're all sweaty and things like that, I'd get that ruled out. That be me if you're my relative simplistically. And it could be you have an autonomic dysfunction or a variety of other things. But you know what I would do? Sit down with your general practitioner, talk to them about your full history, your full examination, have them look over under the hood, and look at the different things that might be associated with this before you just jump the gun and start making lots of money for sleep disorder laboratories.
Mm-hmm. Wally, did the onset of this sweaty a head condition, did that can you line that up with anything that happened in your life?
No, it's been going on for several years, actually, and sort of accepted it, but I'm middle-aged, overweight, all those things. Maybe I appreciate the doctor's advice.
Yeah, start out with your primary care physician and nurse practitioner.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wally from Bradford. That does it for this hour, except for this. Very quickly, Dr. Dyken, before we have to say goodbye, well, most people we know take coffee. You've got coffee right now to stay awake and alert. Now there's a new brew out. I wonder if you've heard of it. It claims to help Java lovers get to sleep quickly and to stay asleep. Counting Sheep Coffee features a unique blend of decaf beans and approximately 176 milligrams of valerian root. This is a natural sedative found in many herbal sleep aids. What do you think of this beverage innovation?
Well, you know, a sedative that helps you get to sleep. My thought is you always have to be careful with any sedative. If you have untreated obstructive sleep apnea and you're not able to arouse, and that's what our last caller, Wally, had implied. If you're getting low oxygen, your body really wants to wake up. But if you over-sedate it, you may actually be killing yourself with kindness. There are a lot of things out there that may or may not work for you. What I didn't like about some of the people who commented on this said it didn't really taste like coffee. It tasted like coffee-flavored tea. And I sure love the taste of coffee. But, you know, if it works for you and it seems holistic and you're not having any bad side effects of it. That was what bothered me about this one. They said it didn't really taste like coffee. And mm-hmm. I really don't want tea. I want coffee.
Interesting. The inventor of this said he came up with the idea for this sleep-inducing blend because his wife loves coffee but is so sensitive to caffeine, she can't even drink decaf in the afternoon. Decaf, I think, has a small amount of caffeine you have to watch out for if you're particularly sensitive.
Yeah, and that would be a shame. Because nothing smells better than coffee. But I do use it as medicine. To get through this hour, it's been just helpful because it's so early in the morning with these night owls like me. You know.
Dr. Eric Daikin is director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He joins us 3 or 4 times a year to update us on some of the latest news and research on sleep and to answer your questions. Thank you very much, Dr. Daikin. Until next time.
Yeah, thanks again.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, wishing you the best of night's sleep.
Right in front of me, but it's getting